Welcome to Polycast, a Civilization podcast focused on game strategy.
Dan Q.
Makalua.
Imran Siddiqui.
The Mian Team.
You are listening to episode 84 of Polycast. I'm Dan Q, and I'm joined by Makalua.
Hello.
If you recall, back in our second season, a composite show where we had archive segments from previous episodes that got cut due to time. Well, this episode is the exact same thing, except it's for our third season. We hope you enjoyed our Christmas special, and hope that you will join us for Season 4 coming in January 2010.
It's 2010 already? Where's my flying car?
From Episode 60.
Can we talk about the silly challenge?
Yes, one improvement type only, says John MCD. If you were only allowed to build a single type of improvement throughout a whole game of Civilization IV and had to raise any you couldn't build when you captured them, what would you build and how high a difficulty do you think you could win at? Roads, I think I'll allow. So those are accepted, and then he presents the other options. And, you know, really, actually, now that I read this, kind of only paid attention to the first part of his question, this how high a difficulty do you think you could win at? Since that's not part of the poll, I guess I kind of went, that's boring. I don't want to talk about that. I want to just click a button, and I've contributed.
But this idea here is a great idea for a succession game. You could decide on one particular improvement, and then play a succession game where you only build that improvement.
Yeah, so your options are mine, farm, pasture, workboats, plantation, windmill, watermill, cottage, oil well, and banana plantations only.
Banana plantations.
Reading them in the order that they appear in the poll. Right now, farm.
Farm's winning.
With 7 votes, followed by 4 for cottage. And when I was looking at that, I was actually trying to decide between the two myself. And on balance, I went with farm.
Yeah, because even if you had mines and you had your metals, you still wouldn't be able to grow your cities as big. And that would be a real choke for you, especially if you got stuck in bad terrain.
But if you don't have mines, you're going to have no defensive units. Axemen are just going to swarm all over you. It doesn't matter how big your cities are.
Well, you'll have a bunch of archers. You'll eventually have longbows, which are kind of tough.
And catapults, rifles.
Uh-huh. You won't be able to go to war necessarily.
Well, longbows.
Well, you'll have gunpowder units later.
Yeah, if you survive that long.
Yeah, that's the tricky part. Getting through archers across to longbows and then trying to survive to gunpowder. I wouldn't be trying this on much higher than, what is it, prince that's even?
Nobles even, prince is one above.
Hint, don't try this on deity.
And later on in the post, they point out that you've missed a few improvements, one of them which was forts. And then someone, Ming, pointed that out. But as soon as you allow forts, you open up all the metals because you could put a fort on copper and get your metal that way.
Right.
Or, and someone pointed this out, you could settle on the copper and get your metal that way.
Mm-hmm. It would be nice if it was on a hill. Extra defense.
Yeah, yeah. Personally, I'd go with farms, run a specialist economy, settle on some stone somewhere and build pyramids. Game over. Well, we've played that game. Next game.
My favorite is oil well. Short of maybe an advanced start, do you think you're going to be able to survive to get built?
Yeah.
I'm impressed with your optimism.
You can't build any improvements, so your first thing you normally build in your... You found your city and you start a worker. And you finish your worker and then you have to wait to oil wells to actually use him. Oh, you could build roads.
Yeah, you can connect your cities, but the rest of the time you're just going, do-do-do-do-do.
I'm going to road here, and I'm going to road over there, and I'm going to road over here.
From episode 76. Come on into the research lab where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future. Workboats and bridges, thread by Amy and Beatles. Have you ever had an island and there was a one-tile ocean between it and it was a bother to move workers' units over there using boats? Well, how about using the workboats to create bridges? They would work like a road, and then gave a few details. Before I get into that, Kamikaze said from at outset, he said, in preface, I think a better idea would be to have workers and workboats create bridges, where a workboat would be needed to be on the tile, and then a worker could be loaded onto the workboat to carry out the bridge building. At completion, the worker would be automatically unloaded, and then the workboat used up. In my opinion, this represents the significant infrastructure investment of a bridge better than merely having a workboat creating it.
I really wouldn't mind a ferry improvement or something like that for a city that's off on an island or something.
The micromanagement for archipelago maps and other times where you just get over these little one-tile water bridge really annoying. It would make playing as Inca, for example, on Earth 18 so much more palatable.
What I found interesting about Kamikaze's post there about having workers and workboats creating bridges is when he then went with this person's suggestion, responding to it, and the poster said ability would only be available after researching a certain technology. She said construction or engineering. Kamikaze says engineering and construction are too early, in my opinion. Really, such large-scale bridges were only possible in the last century, quote-unquote. I don't know, we've talked before about just how much land does one tile really represent.
Which, of course, depends on the map size.
Exactly. And then he says, perhaps a tech like composites could allow this.
By the time you get to composites, why bother?
Yet you're saying in preface you would rather have workers and workboats create bridges, yet but then the worker wouldn't be able to do it until composites? What?
Yeah, what?
That's not consistent. Again, I don't know which way you're trying to go with this.
By the time you get to composites, it's not going to be an issue because you'll have airlift and things. And we're talking about we need something in the early game, so I'm not sitting there having to have 3 or 4 galleys just to manage taking units and workforce across.
In fairness to Kamikaze, that was his initial suggestion, just like construction or engineering was the original poster suggestion, Amy and Beatles. And it was, composites is a bit late, in my opinion. Yes, my opinion too, and I think everyone here. Perhaps there could be a special industrial era technology allowing this. And I like Kamikaze's response, which inherently said, no, we don't need a special industrial era technology allowing this. When I see something like special industrial era technology, I'm thinking, you're going to create another technology on the technology tree specifically to allow this? I mean, that was my interpretation. But Kamikaze said, perhaps industrialism would be a good tech to allow bridge construction with. Again, that's...
Come on.
Wow, that's...
Maybe earlier than that. Steel? Steel or physics? It should be relatively early, because if I have one deposit of horses in my empire, and it's stuck on an island, I want to get to that pretty damn quick. But, I mean, how big a problem is this?
It's just a convenience issue. It's so annoying when you have 4, 5, 6 cities across little amounts of coast.
Yeah.
And it takes, like, triple the amount of micromanagement just to do the same thing as if they were on the same landmass. Because even waypoints won't work.
Right.
If people won't buy into the early bridges, then I would just rather have it automatically use a workboat or a galley as a ferry, and you could just lock it in place as if it were a land tile and just do that then.
Yep.
Instead of a fortify button, you have a ferry button.
Right.
Sure. I mean, why not? If it's only one tile, or maybe you could create like an up to 2 coastal tiles bridge of galleys or something. And that way your units could just move across it.
Perhaps you could take, say, your workboat, designate it as a ferry, and then if a unit moved into the workboat, and if that unit, say, had 2 movements per turn, or even 1, if you said you make it a ferry so it has to stay there, you can't use it for anything else, it could, say, be open to attack, as the original poster said, and you'd have to defend it, then when the person went on there, go on and come off the ferry in the same turn.
Possibly. I wouldn't want it to be seen used as, like, long road network or something, though, or... something that actually accelerates the movement of land units past what they could do with roads, or even with roads, because it does represent somewhat of an obstacle to have water in your way.
Yeah, just make it cost 1 full movement point to get across the ferry. A faster unit could load faster and unload faster, so to speak.
Mm-hmm.
Yeah, I guess that could work.
Let's see, what else did this person say here? During times of war, enemy ships can blockade them, so they're unable to be used. Yeah, I suppose you sit right on them. Enemy ships could also pillage them. Oh, yes. This is interesting, quote-unquote. They can be built in either friendly or neutral territory. If built in neutral territory, any player can use them. That's an interesting question. Would you want to make it so that, as an improvement, is something that you could only build if that tile was inside your cultural borders?
Well, I think the person's suggestion makes more sense for bridges than a ferry system. Because obviously you wouldn't have to ferry people you didn't want across.
Yes.
I don't see what's wrong with building it in neutral territory, but allowing others to use it then. I mean, if that comes to harm you, it's your fault for building it.
Yes, yes.
If they ferry the army across and forget to tell you, well, that's your fault.
Don't they have to pay you like 1 or 2 gold pieces per unit or something?
Toll!
The Ferry Master?
There you go.
Someone would find a way to abuse the AI on that and get them to repeatedly move the same
backwards and forwards.
it would happen somehow.
One technology to be able to build the bridge and then another technology to be able to collect tolls. Woo!
And then another technology for defending against the troll that lives under the bridge.
That could be a random event. Oh, I like the point about perhaps there could be a limit to how many units can be on it at the same time. No good to have 150 tanks on a bridge because it would most likely collapse. Well, yeah, you could have some kind of limit on there. If you did something with a ferry, maybe this is getting too complicated, but you think about the capacity of a particular naval unit. If you assign them as a ferry, except in that case the workboat doesn't carry any units, so that's just unnecessarily complicated. When the bridge is full, it becomes impassable until another unit gets off of it.
You could give the workboat like one carrying capacity or something for that, and every other unit just retain their carrying capacity.
Yeah, you could upgrade your ferries that way as you upgraded through the technology tree, and assuming you built the unit for it.
Or do you make the bridge a particular unit? Instead of building a workboat, you build a work bridge or a bridge boat or something like that. So it's not a galley, it's not a workboat, it's a different unit. Obviously free up the capacity and all of those sort of issues.
No.
You know when the army engineers come to a river, they just throw down some sort of automatic bridge and they roll across it?
Yeah, but not in like 2000 BC.
Maybe not.
Throw rocks into the water to pull it the bridge. You know, in the early game, we're talking about several thousand years. It's not implausible, I guess.
Top 10 reasons why Civilization is better than TV. This is from the suggestions on the thread, and then I chose them, and then I ranked them. From Prez Gores, it is Civ, number 10. Demanos, you can edit Civ 4. You can't edit SpongeBob or Lost or any other TV show. Number 8, from Colervo, you can act intellectually superior to all those poor schmucks who don't play intelligent games. Number 7,
Mick the Mick.
You never curse so loud your entire neighborhood hears it after losing a game of Civ, unlike when watching a game of your favorite college football team on TV.
Yeah, that one's not true.
Would you like to give us a little soundbite of that swearing there, Mackie? You don't swear nearly enough on the show.
Oh, golly gee, I can't believe that just happened to me.
No, that's the Canadian swearing. So, number 6, Civ actually requires skill and encourages improvement. Who said that?
I have no idea.
You said that?
No, I'm kidding. I have the thread up right now.
Really? TV takes a lot of skill. I don't know what you guys are talking about.
Yeah, you know how many people don't know how to get the flashing 12 to stop?
I must say, like, watching certain TV shows for extended periods of time, that could be construed as skill, although I tend to think of it more willpower. Standing, what about it is good? I guess that could take skill, because I don't know how to do it.
Also from Colervo number 5, no commercials!
Yeah.
I did have that at number 5 because now TiVo and the like, I thought, well, there's ways more around commercials than there used to be. If this was 5 or 6 years ago, I would have put that higher on my list. Raid for BBQ. There's always Civ on a laptop during a blackout. That's assuming you've got your battery charged, obviously.
And you're not running Vista.
Amy and Beatles, again, number 3. Once you buy the game, you don't have to pay a monthly fee, unlike cable.
Or WoW.
Oh, yeah, I was about to say, it also has some advantages over that. Number 2, also from Raid from BBQ, and the reasons why Civilization is better than TV. A good game of Civ never gets canceled after 10 episodes due to low viewers.
Well, it could get canceled after 10 turns if Dan starts on a one-tile island.
It won't even make it to 10 turns.
Regenerate.
Then the number 1 reason from L Plate Ruler. If it doesn't end how you like, you can reload for an alternate ending.
Nice.
Can I get a reload button in real life?
Do over.
I would abuse that so badly.
That was just a practice.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy.
The Me and Team's Guide to Speed Sieving. I chose this topic in part because I know I could learn a thing or two. I've definitely gotten better, and it's been thanks to multiplayer that I've gotten better, because the AI really doesn't care how long you take for your turn, but your fellow human players sometimes do.
Turn timer.
But also because you started this thread, Philip, and you're now as your regular co-host, you have to do more work on the show. So I figured this would give you a perfect opportunity to do that so you could talk about it.
Fair enough. All right. Actually, I've been meaning to edit this guide because this was the first guide I wrote. And I haven't really updated it for when I switched from Emperor to Immortal, and now I'm actually starting to offline and even play online games a little bit with Deity. So some of the stuff in here is old. A lot of it's still good. But, for example, I do use Avoid Growth on occasion now, certain situations, and I'm a little bit more streamlined than I was then. But basically, the reason I wrote this guide, someone actually asked me to just do it, because I was playing all those games on strategy and tips in usually under 3 hours. It's my typical game. If it's a hard game where I'm at my highest level and I'm trying to win very carefully, then I might go to the 3-hour, 30-minute range. But it's been a long time since I've taken more than that on both normal speed and on epic speed. So I figured I would just go ahead and write the guide, since a lot of the things I knew, people were saying they didn't know, so put it together.
For the most part, it was reminding me of things that I knew about when I first started playing the game. And it was like, oh, yes, I'm going to get to doing that once I get some of this other stuff down, you know, like being able to survive. And then by the time I got to that, I had completely forgotten about that. I promised myself once I could do that, period, however long it took me to actually survive, then I would try to improve my game. Like reminding me, for instance, how to queue things in my city. And it's just through a few simple clicks it can be done, and I still don't do it. I think the biggest thing that shocked me, though, was that you used the governor. And I guess I've been governor shy because of either what it was like initially, or at least what it was perceived to be like initially when Civ 4 came out. I don't trust the governor.
The governor can still be bad. There's a learning curve associated with using the governor, and I was just willing to do it because I prefer to play so quickly. Really, to use the governor well, you need to memorize its tendencies when you emphasize food, hammers, commerce, great people. I don't really emphasize science a whole lot even now, and also avoid growth. And also take into account the governor's behavior, because it will work different tiles if you have slavery versus not, because it takes into account that you can whip. It also, if you're building wonders, or if you're building wealth, or research, or culture, it will pick different tiles than it would if you're building a more standard building or unit. Now, I actually hate what it does when you build wealth. It's actually really stupid in that regard, and that's when I started using avoid growth. And really not what avoid growth was intended for, but just so that I could get the city to work the tiles I want. Really, using the governor comes down to memorizing what it will do in a situation if you tell it to emphasize this, that, or the other thing. It will always favor working improved tiles for you unless you're building wealth. It's just the question of which tiles it chooses to do. Usually with some combination of food, hammers, and commerce, you can get it on the tiles you want it. And after a while, you don't even need to see it anymore because you just know that's what it's going to do. If you mix that with queuing up what you're doing in each city so that you don't get those pop-ups all the time asking you what to build, you can save a lot of time.
I sometimes use the governor. Most of the time I just leave him on in the default position. But certainly when I'm racing for liberalism or something, I will get him to max science. And the way I typically do that, I do not just click on the science button because for some reason he's not as good as he could be. But I click on the max science and max commerce, and that seems to get pretty close to as good a science as I can get.
That depends on your city specialization. Like if you're talking GP farm or something, you would probably want to emphasize great people and then just click force one specialist like science.
Yep.
Run the specialist there for you. Whereas if you have a city that's almost all cottages, you probably will not see a difference between emphasize research and just emphasize commerce or even both of them. It is going to work all of your commerce tiles first. Well, I mean, it's going to work food specials as a priority and your other special tiles like copper mines or whatever. But after that, it's going to be working cottages or their growth towns or whatever before it works anything else. And then it will pick commerce tiles if you've picked to emphasize commerce after that as well. I still do some swapping of tiles early in the game. It's not like I rely on the governor exclusively. But it is a good stopgap for the majority of the actions you need to take, because most of the time you can get it to do what you want to do without going into the city, which helps. you know, unfortunately, you can't switch tiles between cities that way, but I guess we have to add some input of our own. Can't just let the game play for us.
It surprised me that you said you hardly ever opened the city screen. I hardly ever select builds without opening the city screen.
I almost always click on the city and scroll down to the bottom there.
Hmm.
The only time I really go into cities these days is either to run specialists and make sure that it's running the specialists I want there, or to switch tiles between cities, since you have to do that. Generally, other than that, I will not go into the city. But I have a good memory, too, so I can kind of remember what I've built in cities and the roles for it. And I can generally keep tabs on my cities by memory until I start getting over 10 of them. That's when it starts getting a little harder. But often the game's in pretty good shape if you have more than 10 cities on a standard map. So that's not an issue as often.
Well, I haven't done it yet in your conclusion about how to practice, but being able to give yourself a turn timer and where only you are playing against the AI, a hot seat multiplayer game where you are the only player other than the AI, I hadn't thought of that before. That way, if I'm not able to make all the decisions I want to in a particular turn or multiple turns and I get screwed in the game, nobody else knows but me. That's...
That's true. If you start with phasing, it forces you very quickly to start adjusting aspects of your play so that you can finish turns within that time period. But to me, blazing feels kind of slow now.
Realms Beyond, they run a whole series of non-competitive epics and adventures. And they had a venture a while back, a Venture 31 Speed Racer, where the object of the game was to win in the shortest amount of elapsed time. The game I played there, I won the game in 41 minutes with a cultural victory. Most others were around the 90-minute mark. Nearly everyone went for culture because it's just a matter of click, 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 click at the end, and you can really zoom through the game.
Hey, other than like speed conquest on a smaller map on like Marathon, where you just run from one city to the other, burning it on like lower difficulties, yeah, I have a hard time picturing something going faster than the Apostolic Palace, just because your tech investment to do it is really low.
Yeah, this was Monarch difficulty, Beyond the Sword, quick speed on an inland sea map.
That would favor culture a little bit more because of how it scales.
Yeah, the 25,000 limit, which is pretty close.
From episode 80.
Greetings from the mailbag, where we address listener questions and comments.
It's been a while since we've had a mailbag segment on the show. Every once in a while, I'd say once every 3 or 4 months, I go on to Google and I type in Polycast and Civ, both in quotation marks, because if you just type in Polycast, you're going to get a lot of industrial applications for Polycast. Something that came across actually just in June of this year on a forum I had not heard of before, a weekly independent gaming podcast by gamers for gamers called NoobTube.
So with two O's, yes?
Yes.
Very good.
Where someone had said, I'm giving someone a recommendation of where to find out about Civ. On iTunes, you may want to check out The Polycast, a podcast about Civilization. After starting to listen to this podcast, I found myself starting to use different tactics from those that I was using before. Thank you for saying that. S-A-I-G-H, dear. Say dear. But I noticed you didn't tell us whether or not these different tactics improved your game or not. I understand why you were avoiding commenting on that. You didn't want to make us feel bad.
No way. I'm sure the nuking and raising every single coastal city has come to use, at least. Come on.
In response, Captain Red Chops says that Polycast has its pros and cons. They certainly waffle on a lot. I was trying to think, what are you getting at? And all I can think of is the fact that when we introduce most topics anyway, we address either both sides of the story, or in a lot of cases, there's more than two sides, and we discuss each one of those, whether or not we agree upon it. I suppose there are times when none of us really give an opinion about what we think. We just present other people's opinions and say, here they are. But if you're suggesting then that we need to be more opinionated on the show, which is how I'm going to take this, then we can so totally do that.
That's true. I think our biggest failing in terms of waffling would be when we're in the research lab, because sometimes we give a negative opinion, but sometimes we're just not sure on it. And part of the reason for that is it's difficult to decide whether implementing something without any trial at all would actually cause a positive or negative effect. But I suppose we could ignore that and just kind of guess.
Yeah.
and then say, you know, either this is a good idea or a bad idea explicitly rather than waffling a little bit. Because I know we do.
But I don't know, it gives a good picture of it. Even if we're not sure, we can say, oh, it might be good if this happened, or it could be bad if these things happened, and so on. But I think it's better to sometimes elaborate rather than be far too brief on the topic.
Yeah, well, that's true. One of the strengths of this, I feel, is the way the strength of the topics we pick.
Yep, but I guess we could, in the end, say people are actually listening to the show for our opinion.
You're wrong.
People like strongly expressed opinions. That seems to generate viewership.
Yes. Drama is entertaining.
You get that all the time on shows, even on ESPN, where you'll get a commentator who says, this will happen. There's no way he knows that for sure, but he's saying it, and it's getting viewers. So, I mean, that might work for us as well. I don't know.
Yeah.
Or I should say, no, that will work for us.
Yeah.
Absolutely. There's no doubt that will work for us. Might as well, right?
Yeah. Then one person talks about how you block, and another person says, no, you're an idiot. This is how you do it. Stupid.
Just build Axemen. Don't build anything else. Everything else is a waste.
Absolutely wrong. Chariots are better than those.
I like my warriors.
Welcome to the Senate, where we discuss game strategy. Blocking strategy from Red Fury. In the last few games I've played on Emperor, I've gone quite a bit out of my way to place a blocking city or two quite often far away from my capital. This can lead to sealing a nice bit of land for around 10 cities, but the initial maintenance costs really hurt if it's your second and third cities. So he asks three questions. How far are you willing to go with your second and third cities to block out a neighbor and secure land? Is placing a city covering the best land in an AI's direction generally enough to deter that AI from settling in your direction in the short term? And are you willing to accept a crappy early city if it creates a good block?
Well, my answer would be that it really depends a lot on the map, obviously. But as a general rule, I usually won't travel more than 10 or so tiles away from my capital because it just becomes impractical with connecting the cities and defending against barbarians in the early game. There's an exceptional blocking location and no sieves on my side of it, something like a one-tile choke point between two landmasses or something. I might consider maybe going up to 20 tiles away, but that's sort of pushing it. Mostly I find the best bet is just to expand close to my capital, grab some copper or horses, and go invade my neighbor, because that just usually works better than founding second and third cities dozens of tiles away and creating a weak and patchy empire.
I like expanding towards the AI. And if expanding towards the AI, I see that I can block. If I realize, oh, I could expand towards the AI and go to location X and block them now, or I could expand towards them but not be blocking them and go to Y, well, of course I'm going to go to X and block them off. But as you said, it really depends on the map, and it depends on how close your neighbors are. Blocking just for blocking's sake, if the city's going to be crappy but it's going to get me a particular strategic resource that I don't have otherwise, and or deny the AI from getting the strategic resource, that's one thing. But I'm not going to crash my economy, even in the short term, for blocking purposes.
The one thing that was worth settling far away for is to grab a necessary resource.
My answer to number one would be as far as I can go and still actually block. As mentioned already, the AIs will go around, and high-level AIs will go around pretty quickly. Even though I would say I'd be willing to go more than 10, 12 tiles, realistically, unless you have like a kind of narrow landmass, block off all of that with two cities, kind of like a narrow continent vertically or something, then I might go more than 10 tiles away from my capital. But for the most part, it's just impractical because the AI will go around you and then you have this big culture mess. And if it's an aggressive AI, it'll be more likely to declare on you because you share a longer border. And that's not good.
I'm actually playing a game kind of like that right now where I had that sort of continent like you described where there was a whole bunch of land and then this narrow choke point where I realized I could block it all off with just two cities. So I did that and it worked out because I got all this land. But then the main problem was that it just ended up with the third AI sieve that I didn't block also became really, really big.
Well, yeah, if you block land, you're blocking land for yourself. Under no circumstances want to block land that other AIs wind up taking. Same thing with a rush or a choke. Like, if you're going to rush or choke, you're doing it to make sure you get more land. And yes, an AI might get a little bit more land if you do that. But you should be getting the vast majority of it or it's not paying off because you're incurring expense to make the choking or blocking effort or rushing effort.
Yeah.
And you don't want to hand freebies out, especially to an AI with a lot of bonuses that can gobble up land and just develop instantly on it. In terms of blocking at a distance, you want to make sure you have at least pottery, preferably writing as well, but at least pottery before you start settling too aggressively. That way you can get some extra commerce besides just the palace. Or, you know, it's okay if you're settling very far away, but you happen to have a gold in that city or something that lets you pay for it right away. That allows you to be more aggressive as well. Because what you don't want to do is have like 60 turns to research writing or even like 20. It's too slow then, and your recovery takes forever, and you're vulnerable for a longer period of time because of it.
Yeah, you want to wait until at least alphabet if you're going to be settling crazy cities, but then again, by that time, the AI have expanded more. But at least if you have alphabet, usually trade, or sometimes trade, depending on the difficulty level for texts that you might be researching.
Oh, I'm happy with just pottery and writing, because you can run the scientists if you need a high temporary tech rate. And what you usually do then in single players, research aesthetics, because the vast majority of AIs put that off. And you can use that to trade from, so it's a safer bet. And yeah, you still use the binary research, and you know, turn your slider down after you get writing and accrue gold, and then use it to spend on 100% once you get your library in, at least in your commerce city. And you can usually get to that and start your trading game then. But at least with pottery and writing, you're working reasonably developing commerce tiles, and you have a chance at teching somewhat. The more happiness you have before monarchy, the more aggressive you can be, because you can work additional tiles. I think a lot of people lose the value of charismatic there, with its ability to get the +2 happiness in each of its cities. Get to work an extra 2 cottages in the commerce city, and basically work more of everything early in the game. It's got more economic output than people give it credit for.
With regards to this place of a city and covering best land in the AI's duration, generally enough to deter them from settling your duration, I'd say definitely not. The AI can be bastards in my experience. Sometimes I've had them settle right next to cities with the resources to attempt to steal them. They have no qualms about around your territory to found a city in the middle of land that you've half blocked off. So that you really have to either fully block it off or not try it, because they'll just get around any way they can.
Yeah.
I experimented with this in a recent game. My conclusion was that it buys you time, but it does not buy you a lot of time. The AI will always settle what it feels is its best city site next, and if you take one away, you have to look at the surrounding land, and you have to have a pretty good idea for what the AI is going to favor. It's going to take the next best city site, and if the next best city site happens to be, say you're directly east of the AI, and you settled right up on it west, whereas it would have settled that same city site that you just settled if you didn't do it, but you beat it there. Well, now there's a chance it'll go southeast, northeast, but it could also go straight south or to its west as well, depending on where the next best city site is. So if you can see the land around it, you might realize that putting a blocking city there will start a block and get it to settle away from you for, you know, maybe 1 or 2 cities and give you a chance to get another quick settler to finish the block. But again, it's advanced in that you have to be able to read what the AI will do in that situation in response to you blocking it.
Yeah.
And of course, I hope it doesn't declare on you, since you're probably going to be a sitting duck for a little while.
You can also have trouble if you settle blocking cities on choke points. Sometimes the AI will just build galleys and send their settlers around behind your choke point city, which could be a pain in the butt.
In that case, it's kind of closed borders. So you have to keep an eye on
them. Yeah, declare war if necessary.
Yeah, if you do block them, you have to decide, do you keep closed borders with them for a long time and risk the war, or do you open borders and risk them going through?
AI will not travel through your culture with a settler to settle a city, unless it's in a galley.
Really?
I find it's a kind of a weird, fluky exception. But yeah, it'll bypass your cities in a galley to settle around, but it will not go through your culture with open borders. That was a big problem in Vanilla, and I guess Fire Axe has decided to annoy players sufficiently to remove it.
Huh, okay.
Now a block is successful until they get sailing and start building galleys. So you get some time there. But fortunately, if you keep an eye out and you see them starting to pass a galley through your territory, then you can just quickly close borders for a little while until you set coastal sites. But like, say you have an inland site completely surrounded by your culture, to my knowledge, the AI will never settle that peacefully.
Huh. Okay. That is really annoying when you're like, come on, that's clearly my territory. It just hasn't turned the right color yet, but it's mine.
Well, even their cities are my territory.
So yeah.
It's just a matter of time.
Yeah, exactly. My summary would be that, well, depends on what type of map you're generating, I suppose, but on most maps, you're not usually going to be able to completely block off an AI just with one or two cities. And even if you do block off their land path, they're often going to try to go around by sea or whatever. So I'd say unless you can find a perfect location where you can be sure that they're completely sealed off and it isn't too much work too far away, then just go with settling good cities nearby you and then go to click one.
Well, the other thing is you can aggressively try to grab a good city that's a little bit further away than you'd normally go, even if at risk of them going around you and settling, if it's a good enough city.
Like if it denies them copper or something.
A double gold city with a grassland cow and a riverside corn. Okay.
Yeah.
I would probably run out and get that city.
Yeah, as soon as you can.
It's worth it. That's one of the things I really like about this game. Just the amount of discussion we're having on this shows that this is a very dynamic situation, and it takes a lot of strategy just to decide where to settle your cities and in what order.
Yeah, and the game will play out very differently depending on how you do that.
Oh, yeah, and one of the Immortal games we were playing recently, Silu, he was on the show recently. Unfortunately, I wasn't around. We had completely different games with the same map because I got to a gold site near Korea early and he didn't. And that actually served number two as a good example. Because I settled that city early, Wang Khan didn't go there. He settled south. And it allowed me to block up northward and wall off the territory. Most of it was crappy tundra, but there's still some good seafood sites up there, and more importantly, iron. So when it came time for our Renaissance Wars, neither of us had horse, but I had iron available, and he didn't, so I went cannons, and he had to go with, like, draft rifles and trebuchets, I think, and it made a huge difference in the outcome of the game, start to finish, just from the difference in city sites set on.
From episode 81.
Some guy chopped out Praetorians out of like two or three cities and just kept pressing me and leaving everyone else alone. So of course we both lost. There's nothing we could do. That was annoying. And the other one that really got me bad in multiplayer was an islands map. I got attacked and had my coastal cities burned on me. It's amazing how hard it is to defend against that without having like a very, very strong navy and major advance notice. Because once they're at your shoreline, they're always going to be threatening more than one city. It's not like we're deity AIs where we can just spam units in every single city. So even if you're more advanced to them, and I was almost at rifles, and he just barely had maces, but he had astronomy. But that was enough. I had all my coastal cities burned, and there's no recovering. Well, all but one.
It's pretty much one of the problems with a turn-based game in multiplayer. It doesn't work very well.
Yeah.
If you were playing turn-based, whoever does have the turn has the complete initiative anyway to concentrate their force on a particular spot. When you're defending, you can't move, obviously. So.
Yeah, but that was just a logistics problem. I mean, my cities were more than three tiles apart, but the boats could position themselves between either city, and then it doesn't even matter if it's simultaneous or turn-based. You're going to get screwed either way. It was a good lesson. I picked up on that. It's a very powerful thing to do, but it's a pretty big disaster.
Was it separated sort of land masses?
Yeah, we were on islands.
Yeah. You know, in those games, it's pretty much inevitable that one or two people will get way out in front and go and invade everyone.
Yeah, it was either him or me, but I should have just gone for him right away, because I got to astronomy first. I should have started blockading and causing trouble. Because some guy was actually stupid enough to open borders with me. And then if someone does that when you have astronomy and they don't, you know they're not going to be a threat because they're not thinking right. So I should just let that guy alone and go straight for the guy who was building up military, I guess.
I can never think of one particular military disaster. All I can think of is setting up for military disasters. We're taking too long to prep for war. And then all of a sudden, the AI's archers are now longbowmen. I guess what goes from a disappointment to a disaster is when, just out of frickin' spite and annoyance, I attack anyway. But that bring that upon myself. I wish I could blame that on the AI, or my worst disaster on human player, but I can't. Not in good conscience.
The thing is, though, if you're prepping military, you're sacrificing a lot of your other potential output to the extent that you've kind of pigeonholed yourself. If you really want a successful attack, you have to commit to it frequently, especially against high-level AIs. So then if they do suddenly get rifles or whatever, you're kind of screwed. I mean, you can try to go for the next military tech lead then, but by the time you do that, they could easily be there since they weren't sacrificing their technology on military like you are. So it's hard. Then you have the problem, if you don't build a military, then they might attack you if you don't have good diplomacy or surviving fights and still teching at the same time. Players can do it, but it's not easy, especially on the high levels.
Well, there was that time in our multiplayer game where I tried to rush and then I ended up playing in OCC for the rest of the night.
Oh, yeah. Oh, we had that fun one, too, where we were both trying to attack that protective hill city. And we lost so many units. I eventually got it when I got catapults, but... it took a long time to recover from that.
Kill cities. They're awesome when they're on my side.
From episode 83.
Come on into the research lab, where we explore concepts that are not in Civ yet, but maybe in the future.
Binary research, the practice of switching intermittently between 0 and 100% research rate in Civ to get the most money. So you set your research rate as and then sets at 100% when you have better multipliers to yield research. There's a lot of multipliers that go into how much research actually goes into the tech you're researching. First of all, there's a slight bonus in the beakers you get based on how many Civs know the tech you're researching already.
If you've met them.
Basic idea of binary research is to maximize the effect of the multipliers when you are running 100% research rate.
The other major discount that comes from something outside of your own multipliers is when you have prerequisite technologies for it. Those aren't any. Those are just the prereqs that have a line going from one tech to the next. So, for example, three different technologies will give a discount on writing. Priesthood, animal husbandry, and pottery. Whereas nothing gives a discount on astronomy, since there's no lines to it. Obviously, with the prereq thing, you're not really going to be helped by binary research unless you're trading. With the AIs researching the tech before you, you could potentially benefit quite a bit from that. But probably the biggest is the ability to build your library or even your academy before you turn your slider back up, and then your gold is going more efficiently through multipliers. The other very huge advantage to binary research on higher levels is that you rely a ton on trades, and you want to research a technology that you can trade for many times its beaker worth. The less time you give the AI to research the same tech you're researching before you trade it, the better.
Yeah, I mean, another aspect that I didn't actually think about that much earlier was, let's say you're researching technology A. So when you do the overflow, the research multipliers that go into technology A will then apply to the overflow that go to technology B.
Say you don't research priesthood for a long time. Say you built pyramids and you didn't need it. Well, then you could binary into priesthood and have the discount for the prereqs, both meditation and polytheism, and all the AIs will know it by then. So you can get huge bonuses on that from just those. And then when you run 100% through it, you can overflow quite a few beakers into your next technology after researching priesthood. So this is a good example of why, in addition to the trade caps for we fear you're becoming too advanced, that you don't necessarily want to trade for smaller techs early in the tech tree, because you can use them to vault your tech rate on binary as well.
Someone commented that the modifiers you get when giving overflow, this has been fixed, that you only get the basic beakers when you overflow tech to the next. It used to be that way when the article was written, but yes, I was told it was fixed in a patch some time ago.
That's worth testing. I'm not sure if it has or hasn't.
Call in today.
In North America, the number is 301-637-7659.
That's 301-637-POLY.
In Europe, 44-121-288-7659.
That's 44-121-288-POLY. You can Skype us at the Polycast.
Or email us at thepolycast@gmail.com.
The only thing worse than being talked about is not being talked about.
For more information on Polycast,
our sibling shows Modcast and Revcast,
or about Polycast in general,
log on to the series' official website at thepolycast.net.
Record date?
Assorted, 2009.
Civilization 4, Warlords and Beyond the Sword, sound, clips, copyright, Take Two Interactive. Copyright 2009. Civilized Communication at civcom.net.